welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
I think it exists within the realm of strategic ambiguity, because a military plan is not what you lay bare to the general public, so that you leave an element of surprise, particularly on the part of the enemy forces.
ECOWAS is assembling troops for a possible military intervention in Niger.
But exactly what are those values? They try to talk about discrimination. Uganda is part of the World Bank. So we have not signed up values of the bank that takes away our sovereignty. We are asking them to produce those values. They are not arbitrary. They are not one streetway.
A top Ugandan envoy expresses disappointment over the World Bank's decision to suspend new loans to the East African country.
Well, we think it's a completely disgusting manipulation of the law in order for the ANC to protect one of their own. The rule of law has been trampled on, the procedures of justice have been trampled on, and the government have just invented a new sentence rescission process only to benefit Jacob Zuma.
And South Africa's main opposition party, Democratic Alliance, plans to seek legal redress over the release of former President Jacob Zuma from prison. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The regional bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, is reportedly assembling troops for a possible military intervention in Niger. This after the president of the ECOWAS Commission, Omar Aliou Touré, called for a standby force to carry out a decision by regional leaders following the recent overthrow of Nigerian President Mohamed Bazoum. ECOWAS, which has a policy of zero tolerance for the forceful overthrow of a legitimately elected government, imposed sanctions on Niger shortly after the coup. Meanwhile, the Niger military junta is resisting regional, continental, and international pressure, condemning the coup and the demand for the reinstatement of the deposed president. However, critics say a military intervention is too risky with few rewards. They are calling for a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Niger. For analysis and the latest political development in Niger, I reach Dr. Oluwole Ojewale. He is the regional coordinator for Central Africa at the Institute for Security Studies in the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
Well, I think it exists within the realm of strategic ambiguity, because a military plan is not what you lay bare to the general public, so that you leave an element of surprise, particularly on the part of the enemy forces. And I think ECOWAS is also trying to demonstrate that they can actually implement or activate the deployment of force. And you know, it's a gradual process. So possibly they are saying we have moved from stage one to stage two now, because the initial proclamation is that they will deploy force. So I think they are now walking the talk now by saying we have activated the stage two of the operation. And it's the fact that a standby ECOWAS force will be deployed any moment, I mean, from yesterday.
But some people are suggesting that the military option is too risky and the dividends might not necessarily be that significant. Your take?
Yes, because a war is going to be a zero-sum game for both parties. And I am one of those who are also worried of the war rhetorics about possible deployment of force, because the entire Sahel region is a convoluted state already, with multiple insurgencies stretching from Mali to Burkina Faso to Niger and some part of Nigeria and to Chad. So if you had a new layer of war, it's going to complicate the security architecture and further make for the deterioration of security in the region. Because even if you displace or do you dislodge the junta, there's a possibility of them emerging as the new rebel within the sub-region, and that is definitely going to complicate the security situation in the region. And another fact is that you look at, you count the cost of the potential humanitarian fallout or in a situation of invasion of the country, It is the people that are already impoverished in those rural communities, towns and cities that are going to bear the burden of the potential consequences of war.
So as it stands now, is the diplomatic solution the best way forward to resolve the crisis?
Yes, it is the way to go. And I think there are also some quick wins. If you follow the development, you know that a lot of envoys have been sent. The junta didn't allow some people to actually see the military, the coup leader. But there is a major religious leader in Nigeria and a former governor of the central bank, who Apostle Bill, the former emir of Kano. I think about 3 or 4 days ago, he was able to see the junta, and I believe he has also briefed the president, the chairman of the ECOWAS Commission, and the chairman of the governing authority of ECOWAS in person of the president of Nigeria, and possibly also briefing the ECOWAS. So I think what we need to look for is a win-win situation in which the ECOWAS meets the junta at midpoint. And that, what that probably will look like is to look at a transition window of 12 to 18 months.
But do you see ECOWAS going all out to enforce its stance or its policy of zero tolerance to the forceful overthrow of a legitimately elected government? Now you have about 7 coups or attempted coups in the region, and ECOWAS, some are suggesting that has to prove itself strong, otherwise it will be looked up as a weak, toothless organization or a regional bloc.
Yes, if they don't do it now, there's going to be a continuous domino effect in the region, because 4 out of 15 countries are gone already. And then there are also vulnerable spots in the political landscape of the region. I mean, countries that are also possibly susceptible to coup. And I think because it happened in Guinea, ECOWAS only back without biting. It happened in Mali, it happened in Burkina Faso, now Niger. ECOWAS wants to show that is actually capable of enforcing order and not just being making mere rhetorics about activating all the resources, the security architecture, the military force, and the diplomatic capability that he has to put an end to this.
Dr. Oluwole Ojewale is the regional coordinator for Central Africa at the Institute for Security Studies in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. He spoke with me from Dakar. A top Ugandan envoy is expressing disappointment over the World Bank's decision to suspend new loans to the East African country. Ambassador Adonia Ayebare, Uganda's permanent representative to the United Nations, says the administration in Kampala will continue to consult with the World Bank to resolve any issues. His remarks come after the World Bank announced it was suspending new loans to Uganda due to the country's recent law against the LGBT community. He says the new law contradicts the bank's values of non-discrimination. But Ayebare rejected the move, saying the bank was consulted and its concerns addressed before the law was enacted. For more reaction, I reach Ambassador Adonia Ayebare via Skype. He expressed optimism the World Bank will soon reverse its decision to suspend new loans to his country.
Since the anti-homosexuality law has passed, we have been engaging the World Bank. My president himself has engaged the World Bank, not at the highest level, but senior officials. And actually, their input was key in moderating, if I may use the word, the law. Their concerns were included in the law, to make sure that there is no discrimination. But turn around and make this decision when even consultations are still going on with the World Bank is disappointing.
Well, but Ambassador Ayebare, the World Bank is saying that the law itself sharply contradicts its view or what its values that it holds dear to the bank. And that is why it cannot go ahead to renew loans that Uganda seeks to have or seeks to get from them in the near future. How do you respond to that?
But exactly, what are those values? They try to talk about discrimination.
Yes.
Uganda is part of the World Bank. So we have not signed up values of the bank that takes away our sovereignty. We are asking them to produce those values. We must have signed on them. They are not arbitrary. They are not one streetway. But what are those values that are they talking about? Remember, these are loans with a mix of grants. This is not free money. We have to pay back this money. So we expect now, if I may call them the World Bank, our bankers, treat us with respect. And I can tell you, we've been really in a process of negotiating this law. The president committed time, talked to one of the vice presidents for our region in detail, you know, even looking at the text, incorporated the World Bank's concern at the formulation of the law. And to really turn and do this with all that is bad faith. With all those consultations.
Some people are suggesting that Uganda were, you know, Ugandan officials were consulted to ensure that it does not discriminate against people of Uganda. And that is one of the values that the World Bank is talking about, that it cares more about all Ugandans and not some people who are being discriminated against by the government that has to protect them.
Peter, that's not accurate. I'm telling you that the World Bank, and it's on record, they were engaged in consultations as this law was being... Remember, this law is debated by parliament. It's not made by officials. The parliament of the Republic of Uganda. And they were reacting to a problem in society. And the parliament of Uganda, both political aisles, you know, took on this bill. But even unprecedented, my president, as he was consulting with the parliament, he was consulting the World Bank to really make sure that their concerns are addressed. More to that, in our budgeting process, directives have been to all accounting officers to make sure that our budget is non-discriminatory. So we have went out of our way, which we didn't need to do as a sovereign country, because the World Bank belongs to us. It's not some organization that belongs to somebody. And we went our way to make sure that their views are incorporated. And they have abused that process by coming up with this decision in the middle of consultations, having had an input in that law.
Where does Uganda go from here?
I'm sure that, you know, if there is good faith still remaining in the World Bank, we'll get a solution. What we really are taking offense of is to really consult in good faith. It's not as if we have not consulted with the World Bank, and these consultations are continuing. To make this decision, we think that this was a misguided, under pressure from external forces within the bank and outside the bank to take this decision, but we hope that this will really be rescinded. And I'm very 100% sure that this will be rescinded and we'll continue working with the World Bank. Remember, some of this money goes to refugees funding. You know, Uganda is one of the largest hosts of refugees worldwide. This money goes to address the plight of refugees. This is really humanitarian. It goes at the heart of humanity, which is the mandate of the World Bank. We hope that reason will prevail and will be back to business with the World Bank.
So are you optimistic that consultations will still continue in spite of the stance taken by the World Bank?
Absolutely, absolutely. We think this was a knee-jerk reaction. This was in bad faith, and reason would prevail and would be back to business.
What is the Ugandan government's message to the World Bank at this moment?
Let's continue consultations in good faith. Do not twist. Uganda is a sovereign country, and our sovereignty is not going to be mortgaged.
Ambassador Adonia Ayebare is Uganda's permanent representative to the United Nations. He spoke with me via Skype from New York. Still in Uganda, the M23 is calling on the international community to pressure the administration in Kinshasa to engage with the group and other stakeholders to help restore peace in the DRC. The call follows a co-chair technical committee meeting between President Yoweri Museveni and former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. The meeting, which was held in Entebbe, was aimed to help restore peace in the DRC. The M23 says the decision by representatives of the DRC not to attend the meeting despite repeated promises undermines efforts by the two leaders and the international community to help with the peace process. M23 spokesman Lawrence Kanyuka participated in the meeting. He tells me the group is committed to the talks to find a solution to the conflict in the DRC.
The meeting went well. Let me thank, first of all, President Yoweri Museveni for being in the meeting today, on that day, and President Uhuru, who is the facilitator of the process of peace in East Congo. So the meeting went well. We appreciate the effort and the hard working to find a peaceful resolution on this ongoing conflict in East DRC.
Are you happy with how the meeting has progressed so far? And are you optimistic as a rebel group that a solution will be found to address your concerns and bring peace to DRC?
We don't have no problem, basically. We want to resolve this conflict peacefully. However, the DRC government already blocked the situation. So the DRC government delegation did attend this meeting, refused to come, even though they said they will come on the meeting. Everybody planned for them to be there to discuss and finally to get a peaceful resolution on this going problem in the DRC, but the DRC government didn't attend.
So what does that mean if the DRC government did not attend the meeting?
It means they refused. They want to go ahead with the warmongering plan that they've been doing for some time now. They are ready to fight. They don't want to fix this matter peacefully.
But the DRC government has said that first things first, you need to lay down your weapons in order to bring peace. And you are not disarming in spite of calls in order to address your concerns.
I would say to you, really, for anyone who has knowledge on cantonment disarmament, this comes from the peace process. When you have an agreement, through the agreement, then we know where people could be cantoned and when the disarmament will take and the program of PDDRC will kick on. So you can't jump the gun. So basically, we carry on with the dialogue. Through the dialogue, we achieve an agreement, a formal agreement. We got to implement it. By implementing it, that's where you have a cantonment or disarmament.
Where do you go from here following the meeting?
We're still seeking to solve this problem peacefully. We're still asking the international community to get involved, and we are calling on the DRC government to actually accept the talk and to fix this problem peacefully and to lay down this program of war mongering that kills many Congolese. And we want to have development in our country and peace in our country for us.
Why do you say the government is engaged in war mongering when is in actual fact, the government is mandated by the constitution to protect its people and maintain the country's territorial integrity? Your presence in DRC, it's arguably against that fundamental constitutional mandate. You have been accused, as you are aware, of causing instability and killing unarmed civilians. And that is why some people suggest that a government should not even seek an audience to talk with you, to sit down and have a dialogue with you, because you are a destabilizing force.
And I'm telling you, first of all, we spoke about this question many times. Our presence in the DRC is welcome because we are Congolese. Our parents are there. We are born from there. This is our country. So we are all Congolese, first of all. So you are wrong for saying that our presence is our people, because we are native of Congo and we are Congolese. So for us to speak to the DRC government, and we told you so many times, we withdrew so many areas as the international community requested, and those areas, 95% of them, have been now occupied by FDLR, occupied by the Mai Mai and other forces that are actually being fully deployed by the DRC government, equipped by the DRC government, and which are killing our citizens. I think you have seen it on the social networks, where their houses and villages are being burned and people killed and they cow. So we are calling on the international community to say that we support the facilitator who has got the brilliant idea to call everybody in Kampala for talks. We want to put pressure on the DRC government to come to fix this problem peacefully, because war is no good. There are so many people are dying. We are ready to fix this problem peacefully.
Lawrence Lawrence Kanyuka is a spokesman for the M23 rebel group. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. A Kenyan analyst welcomes as a positive step plans by President William Ruto's government and the opposition to hold talks as part of the effort to resolve the causes behind recent violent protests. Attorney James Mwamu is a former president of the Kenya Law Society. He says both sides form technical committees to establish an agenda and a common platform to hammer out topics, including the cost of living. Opposition demonstrators protested against the high cost of living. The talks, which reports say are scheduled to begin next week, were encouraged by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo to help ease tensions and violent protests that led to deaths and injuries. Attorney James Mwamu tells me that the talks are likely to ease tensions if both sides can come up with a common solution to resolve the high cost of living.
That was an important step by the two protagonists to try to resolve the issues that have been going on. Of course, first there was a meeting brokered by General Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president of the Republic of Nigeria, who met both the former prime minister, Raila Odinga, and of course, President Ruto. And they agreed to form a team to try to resolve the issue. But the most important thing is they actually met to start breaking ground to see if they can narrow down the issues. The two parties have agreed that there is a need to tinker with both the structure of the legislature and also the structure of the executive.
Does the government really have the tools that can mitigate or combat this escalating cost of living?
There's a bit of a challenge. You know, the president just admitted the other day that he painted a picture of a cabinet that actually does not know what it's doing. Kenyans are worried that perhaps we have people at the center who may not be able to deliver. But the other thing is that the Kenya shilling has been weakening every day. And the government seems not to have an agenda on how to deal with the rising cost of living. There's a lot of talk, but they haven't come out with a specific laid out plan on how to reduce the cost of living.
The opposition's other demands include an audit of last year's elections and then a bipartisan reconstitution of the electoral body, respect for political parties, and inclusion of the opposition in national issues. Some people are questioning why the opposition want to relitigate the elections.
The IBC, as it is constituted now, don't have commissioners. So all we have there is a technical staff. One, the IBC must be reconstituted. Now, the challenge that we have is that when you are trying to reconstitute a commission in a polarized environment such as ours, there is a need to listen to other people. Because, you see, the president is also likely to run again in 2027. So he's an interested player. Therefore, if he's allowed to choose the referees, you know, the commissioners of IBC, there is a perception, and that perception is real, that is likely to therefore control not just the narrative, but what is going to happen in 2027. So I think there is a very important point that I think opposition is driving. The other point is this, is that, you see, we do not dwell on history, but if you rubbish history again, you are likely to repeat the mistakes that you have done in the past. So I therefore do not think that it is outlandish, for example, to call for an audit of the last election.
Some supporters of the government say that the protests being organized by the opposition appears to force the government to have a power-sharing deal. However, the leader of the opposition delegation, Kalonzo Musyoka, said the party will not be pursuing a power-sharing deal. How are people seeing this so far?
Well, I do not know where the truth is, but I think that all that we can do is to take a leader by his own word. If the person says that they are not interested in a power-sharing deal, then I do also, therefore, they do not understand why the government will insist that they are interested in a power-sharing deal. The problem with the current government is that because it now controls parliament, it seems not to want to listen to anybody. So that you find like the day before yesterday, the IG, for example, the inspector of police, is saying that the people went and hired the bodies from the morgues to demonstrate or to prove that people were killed by the police. I mean, that is totally outrageous, because you definitely, I know people who are killed by the police. I have records of clients of mine whose relatives were killed by the police. There is evidence of the people who are killed by the police. Their pathologists have done reports showing bullet wounds. So if you have officers such as this who instead of seeing red they are seeing blue, instead of seeing white they are seeing black, then you also take some of the things that they are saying with a pinch of salt.
Attorney James Mwamu is a former president of the Kenya Law Society. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In South Africa, the main opposition party, Democratic Alliance, plans to seek legal redress over the decision to release former President Jacob Zuma from prison due to overcrowding. The former president spent an hour in prison and was released on Friday after the authorities granted him remission status, granted to low-risk or non-violent criminals. Local media reports say President Cyril Ramaphosa signed the agreement, which also saw the release of over 9,000 inmates. But the opposition Democratic Alliance condemned the move, saying it was politically motivated to free a leading member of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC. For more reaction, I read John Steen Hewson. He is the leader of South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance.
Well, we think it's a completely disgusting manipulation of the law in order for the ANC to protect one of their own. The rule of law has been trampled on, the procedures of justice have been trampled on, and the government have just invented a new sentence rescission process only to benefit Jacob Zuma. In doing so, they've had to use 10,000 other criminals in the correctional services facilities as cover to release Mr. Zuma. It is once again shows that the ANC, and particularly President Ramaphosa, will always put the party ahead of the interests of the country and the people of South Africa. This cynical manipulation of the justice system is yet another low for the ANC government and more inspiration by why they should be removed from office.
Are you saying that his release was politically motivated?
In a country with a recidivism rate in the upper 80s, it is very likely that those 10,000 criminals will reoffend. However, this abuse of the rule of law is absolutely politically motivated, and the rescission was specifically designed to suit one person and one person only, and that was Jacob Zuma, because the ANC are unable and unwilling to hold their own accountable, even for some of the most egregious actions. This is not a very good portent for the Zondo Commission, which will, in all likelihood, lead to some of the prosecutions of those involved in state capture, and would obviously then just waive their ANC membership card and not be held accountable. This is a terrible precedent, and it's a smack in the face for the rule of law and due process.
Why do you think this undermines the rule of law?
Because there is no overcrowding problem. If there has been an overcrowding problem, it's been around for many, many years. Why is it that the moment Mr. Zuma is incarcerated, there's suddenly an overcrowding problem in the prison system? This is not a mere coincidence. It's a clear show of collusion between the government and the prison officials to ensure that Mr. Zuma did not have to spend any time in jail.
What does the DA intend to do about this, since you said it undermines the rule of law?
Well, we will immediately take the decision on review. It was only because of the DA's review application that Mr. Zuma was going back to jail in the first place. We will once again approach the courts and tackle this decision on the basis that it is unreasonable and irrational. and the fact that there's been a cynical manipulation of the justice system to achieve a political objective rather than a legal one for the ANC.
What do you say to those who say that President Zuma just returned to South Africa after seeking medical attention abroad, and that putting him in an overcrowded, so to speak, jail, that will further imperil or endanger his life?
I fundamentally disagree that Mr. Zuma is ill. Just a week before he was notionally getting medical attention, he was representing Belarus at a conference. There's nothing wrong with Mr. Zuma, just as there's absolutely nothing wrong with Mr. Zuma's financial advisor, Shabir Sheikh, who was also released 10 years ago because he was terminally ill. He is still healthy and well and very much alive. There's absolutely nothing wrong with Mr. Zuma's health. And in any event, there are many, many other criminals who are currently incarcerated who are in far worse health than Mr. Zuma and who have not got the luxury of having a government abusing positions and their powers to release them.
What do you say to those ANC supporters who are pointing to the fact that Zuma has been in jail before, so saying that his release due to what the government described as overcrowding in the jail system should not be seen as undermining the rule of law or the criticism being leveled by the Democratic Alliance?
Well, they're fundamentally wrong. The principle of equality before the law and the rule of law are foundational principles for the survival of any democracy, wherever it may be in the world. Just as undermining the rule of law here and throwing out the principle of equality before the law will cause huge damage to the South African fabric and also sends a terrible precedent that in future ANC cadres who are found guilty of crimes are simply going to be able to waive their party membership card and get out of jail free.
John Steenhuisen is the leader of South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. The Nigerian Medical Association is calling on the government to step up efforts to resolve the labor dispute with the striking resident doctors. Dr. Uche Ojima, president of the group, says his organization will continue to work with leaders of the striking doctors and representatives of the government to resolve the dispute. The Medical Association's call came after members of the Association of Resident Doctors launched daily protests and picketing at the offices of the Ministry of Health, Head of Civil Service, as well as federal and state tertiary health institutions across the country. The National Executive Council of the Nigeria Association of Resident Doctors says the move is necessary to press home its demands. The group recently embarked on a strike action to demand better working conditions due to what it says is the government's failure to negotiate salary increases and the payment of arrears owed to them. For more on the calls for a quick resolution of the dispute, I reached Dr. Uche Ojima in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The fact is this, most of the issues in that document are things that should have been done without any controversy. I mean, that you have approved payment of allowances for training people and they are going for exams, they are doing the training, they do not need to fight to be paid. That is what I strongly believe as a person. Other outstanding issues like arrears of salary, and as you know, it's an anomaly in a civilized society to owe your worker. And so, if you look at it, to me, it's a bit embarrassing that we are at that point of having a conflagration over such simple matter. Even though the government is new, we believe that government is a continuum, and therefore, they should quickly do those things to save the nation unnecessary embarrassment.
Some people are expressing concern that since the government is new and is trying to put its feet together, the resident doctors, they said, should give the government a little bit of time to get its footing right in order to meet its concerns. Do you think that concern is legitimate?
Well, these are issues of morals. It is not issues of law anymore. This government is new, but it has also been able to borrow money and giving some parts to legislators, giving some parts to these people and that people within this short period of time. And the fact remains that they are not preparing a budget now afresh. They already have a budget for 2023 in place. And they will always tell you that these monies are in the budget. So if they have been budgeted for, and you came in and government is a continuum, because during one of the negotiations in May, I remember telling the government officials, we don't want to hear that the other government has gone, this is new. They say, no, government is a continuum. So we are not here for sentiment, we are here for facts. In 2 months, they could have done all those things, and they have had 2 months. I pray for them to succeed, but they need to do what they need to do.
What other help can you give to your younger buddy in order for them to have this result? Because this is a labor dispute.
Well, the fact is that we just didn't make a release. We have interfaced with NAG, interacted with them, have also joined them in reaching out to government and attending meetings. So we are working actively behind the scenes in collaboration with them to quickly get to an end. We don't have enough consultants, so we need our residents back so that the training can progress and we produce more people. I'm hoping that the developed nations would allow them to stay to work for us. So we are working with them.
Some Nigerians are saying this is not the time for strike or labor dispute because under the prevailing conditions, they are the ones who are suffering. If the doctors or the resident doctors are on strike, since there will be less hands to handle the already shortage in the system. Your reaction to that?
If this is the time to remove fuel subsidy, I don't think this is not the time to fight to also feed yourself and be alive. We have time to remove fuel subsidy, and everybody is grappling with the reality. If you set off the economy on a spiral, you don't blame me for saying I need help to survive. So all those things to me, they look like blackmail. What I expect an average Nigerian to say is this due to them? Give it to them. That is it. Yeah, we can appeal to them to consider, like we're also doing as a bigger party. We are working together. We're also trying to balance the equation so that Nigerians don't lose totally. So we are on it.
Your last words for the government and for the people of Nigeria, as well as the resident doctors who are right now in dispute with the government.
Thank you to the people of Nigeria first, and especially our patients. I wish to profusely apologize that issues got to the point of disrupting service to you. Even though within the hospital system, we are doing all we can to provide skeletal services and maintain the outpatient clinics running. But please be patient with us, work with us to make sure that we don't usually get back to this point where government sign agreements and make promises they will not keep. People don't need to fight to be promoted. So we apologize, but please bear with us. To the resident doctors, you are part and parcel of the Nigerian system. I know you have the milk of human kindness flowing in you. So also work towards considering so that if things improved and outlined, you quickly return to work. To the government, we pray for your success. We wish you well. Please wish us well so that things will go well. Thank you very much.
Dr. Uche Ojima is president of the Nigerian Medical Association. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Emmett McHenry, a prominent African-American computer guru, has been officially inducted into Igbo ancestry. The induction occurred during the first Ohanaeze North America Town Hall meeting and Igbo ancestry ceremony recently held in Washington, D.C. McHenry is the chairman and CEO of Cycurion, an acquisition company focused on building end-to-end security solutions. He is credited with developing the .com code for internet emails and traces its origin to Igbo land in Nigeria. General William Ward, the first commander of the U.S. Africa Command in Stuttgart, Germany, in 2007, was also inducted into Igbo ancestry at the same ceremony. Ohanaeze Ndigbo is a socio-cultural group that seeks to speak and represent all Igbo groups across the world. For reaction to his induction into Igbo ancestry, I sat down with Emmett McHenry here in Washington.
I was very moved emotionally. And I talked to my son later, and he was very moved as well. He was there. And it really, part of the being so moved is that as a person of African ancestry living in North America, You meet lots of people who can talk about their ancestry. Oh, my family came here in 1432. Oh, my folks came here in only 1940. But we go back to the king of this or that. As a person of African ancestry here, we don't have that rootedness in our head, that knowledge. And since I was a little kid, I've always wondered, where in Africa am I from? And how did my family get here? Did someone sell me and my ancestors? Was there a war? What happened? But all of those questions went out of the way. Just the fact that not only am I part of the Igbo nation, the Igbo people, but that they acknowledge me and they warmly wrap their arms around me. That's very special.
But for the first time, this was organized here in Washington, or North America, if I may put it that way, and you were inducted. How significant is this for you?
You know, legacy starts with something significant, right? So for me, my family, my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren can point back to that moment and say that we are part of the Igbo people. Not only we are part of it, but they wrap their arms around us and acknowledge us. They acknowledge my great-great-great-grandfather for his contributions. That's pretty special.
So talk to me about how you were able to trace your ancestry all the way to Igbo land.
Two pieces. One piece is the travel of my gene pool in North America, but the most important piece is the DNA. So between the DNA and the travels, you know, there are a lot of Igbos landed in North America. And in North Carolina's, where people were sold and then went into South Carolina, people were sold, going into the Mississippi's. On my mother's side of the family, our gene pool was anchored heavily in Mississippi and then began to migrate out. So tracking those pieces gave me the knowledge. And I spent a lot of time in Africa and a lot of time with my dear friend Kingsley Obagi roaming around the continent. So I'm pretty sharp about that piece.
You know, a lot of people have talked about the ingenuity of the Igbo people. Would you say that you got that? You are a computer guy. You were credited for being the father of the dot-com movement, literally. Would you say the ingenuity of the Igbo people might have rubbed off on you?
Interesting question. There are two things that I may... My great-grandmother. I knew my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother very young. She was amazingly, had great ingenuity. And she, whenever I have hard times, I call upon her. She was a leader of people. And I hold that dear. My godfather, who is my mother's cousin, same great-grandmother, etc., highly started as a janitor, ended up owning a trash collection business, ended up owning a scrap metal business, ended up owning a pig farm, all starting with one idea, looking at what people needed, providing a service, and then begin to aggregate pieces. So there's a lot of history in the family of people stepping forward, taking limited resources and developing something very special with those things. It is who I am. I mean, I can't, I sleep very little because my brain is always going with the next kind of thing to do this or that. Yes, talk to other Igbos and see what happened.
Emmett Makeri is a prominent African-American computer guru and the CEO of Cycurion. He spoke with me from here in Washington. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Emmanuel Tnamara.
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, wherever a man goes to dwell, his character goes with him. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.